From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Well, we're less than 10 years from the end of the century, less than 10 years from the end of the millennium. On this edition of Fresh Air, cultural historian Hillel Schwartz tells us about the prophecies of doom and the predictions of a new age that spread at the end of an era. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward just got back from an international rock conference in France and a recording session in Germany. He has some new records to play for us that show how rock is reflecting the political changes in Europe. World music critic Milo Miles plays us some art rock from Japan. And critic Laurie Stone reviews the new photo book, A Kiss is Just a Kiss. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. Former Salvadoran President José Napoleón Duarte died today at his home in San Salvador. Duarte had been suffering from terminal liver and stomach cancer. Despite his illness, which was diagnosed in May of 1988, Duarte served out his five-year presidential term, which ended last June. He was 64 years old. A judge in Carroll County, Kentucky today sentenced the man convicted of causing the nation's deadliest drunk driving accident. Mary Ann Zalesnik of member station WNKU has this report.
Judge Charles Satterwhite sentenced Larry Mahoney to 16 years in prison, the exact sentence the jury recommended in December. Mahoney was convicted of driving drunk and hitting a church bus, which caused the death of 27 people in 1988. The defense had asked the judge to grant Mahoney probation so he could talk to students about the perils of drunk driving and volunteer in an emergency room to work with trauma patients. However, Judge Satterwhite said the families of the victims wouldn't soon forget the accident, so a sentence was necessary. Mahoney's attorney, William Summers, does plan to appeal the sentence. For National Public Radio, I'm Marianne Zalesnik in Carrollton, Kentucky.
A spokesman for the Colombian government said today that leftist guerrillas killed 7 soldiers in an attack on an army outpost in northern Colombia. According to the official, rebels of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia attacked the outpost, located some 175 miles northeast of the country's capital, during the pre-dawn hours. The guerrillas were repelled after a 2.5-hour battle. It's unknown if the rebels suffered any casualties. Earlier this week, another Colombian rebel group announced that they would begin targeting American officials in that country to protest U.S. influence and intervention in Colombia. The United Nations General Assembly this afternoon adopted a political declaration and a global program of action for drug control. Linda Fasula with member station WNYC reports from the United Nations.
Proclaiming the 1990s the UN decade against drug abuse, the General Assembly unanimously adopted an anti-drug plan that emphasizes a shared responsibility among all nations to fight the drug war. The plan calls on developed countries to reduce demand and to compensate those developing nations that reduce illicit production. Nations are urged to ratify the 1988 Convention Against Drug Trafficking by the end of 1990. That treaty contains the strongest provisions yet to counter the economic power of drug traffickers. UN observers note that while today's anti-drug plan is not legally binding, it can have enormous political value. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the United Nations.
West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl will fly to the U.S. tomorrow for weekend talks with President Bush. The two will be meeting at the presidential retreat at Camp David. It's expected that the major topic of discussion will be East and West German reunification. This would include steps to keep a merged Germany in the NATO alliance once reunification talks take place. Prices were lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 11 points, closing at 2664.19. This is NPR. The Justice Department today defended a possible deal it's been negotiating with the Exxon Corporation. The deal involves possible criminal charges stemming from last year's Alaska oil spill by an Exxon tanker. The proposed agreement has been called a sweetheart deal by a lawyer for environmentalists and Alaskan residents. It's also been attacked by Alaska's Attorney General, who has expressed disappointment that Exxon may end up paying less than $500 million in criminal penalties for environmental damage. Any plea deal would let the giant oil company escape a criminal trial for its role in the nation's worst oil spill in history. A plea agreement, however, would have to be approved by the state of Alaska. Michigan Governor James Blanchard today vetoed legislation requiring parental consent for minors seeking abortions. Sally Isley of Michigan Public Radio reports.
The governor vetoed the legislation with only a brief statement for reporters.
I strongly support parental involvement in the most difficult and agonizing decision regarding a crisis pregnancy. But I must veto this bill because it takes a woman's right to help herself away from her.
It's not expected the legislature will have the two-thirds majority needed for an override, but this is not the end of the debate over whether minors should be required to have parental consent when seeking abortions. Barbara Listing, president of Michigan Right to Life, says her group will likely launch a petition drive that could put the issue on the November ballot. For National Public Radio, I'm Sally Isley in East Lansing, Michigan.
The Justice Department said today that it will ask the Supreme Court to review a federal judge's finding that a law Congress passed last year to ban flag burning is unconstitutional. A Justice Department spokesman said a notice is being filed in a federal court in Seattle today to advise of its intention to appeal Wednesday's ruling by a judge there. The government will then have 30 days to file its brief in the high court. The law that forbids desecration of the flag also provides for a direct appeal of its constitutionality from federal district court to the Supreme Court. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're almost 2 months into the final decade of the millennium. Uh-oh, if the prophets of doom are right, 1999 could bring the end of the world. On the other hand, some say the year 2000 will usher in a new age of higher consciousness. End-of-the-century prophecies and fantasies are the subject of Hillel Schwartz's new book, Century's End, A Cultural History of the Fin de Siècle from the 990s through the 1990s. Schwartz is also the author of a cultural history of dieting called Never Satisfied. Well, we looked up Hillel Schwartz in the literary reference book Contemporary Authors. In the part of the entry where authors usually describe their hobbies, Schwartz says, "I'm most interested in how the world is going to end."
I did that partly because I felt that I had been working on that subject for a long time. I'm not particularly concerned, in fact, about how the world is going to end per se, but rather how we always think about and react to notions of finality, especially when we get aground into groups and we begin to think about the world ending and what will we do with our children. The group that I earlier studied about 1706 had the idea that the world was going to end at that time. And they had the problem then of what to do with children. What do you do when the world is going to end? Do you educate your children? Do you worry about your children at all? So when you come to the end of things, one of the major concerns people seem to have is with the continuity of generations and what kind of world will be if there is something after that end.
Does the end of a century and the end of a millennium bring on a lot of end-of-the-world type thinking?
A great deal. There's a compounded interest now, of course, in the ends of things because we're coming both to the end of a century, which naturally encourages such thoughts, at least since the 1300s, and the end of a millennium, which encourages even greater prospects of a finality or a new age coming into being after that.
Why do you think that just like the changing of numbers, you know, because that's really what it is, should bring on this apocalyptic thinking?
Well, yes, it's arbitrary. But it's no more arbitrary and no less arbitrary than coming to the age of 40 and suddenly coming to grips with your mortality. So we seem to see in our own ages significant numbers. And this is a tradition that's gone back farther than the Greeks with the idea of climacterics, critical points in one's life every 7 or 14 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're heading to the year 2000. Now, the only other evidence we have of how people responded to the end of a millennium was, I guess, in the year 1000. Did you come across any record of what the expectations were, what the predictions were as that first millennium ended?
First, I have to say there is a legend which we cannot extirpate no matter what we do as historians, no matter what we do looking for the records. The legend says that in the year 999, people panicked, believing that the world would come to an end in that year 1000 or that the Antichrist would come. The legend has it that people gave away their goods, that they went on pilgrimages, they went to shrines, and we have no good evidence that any of that occurred. But I cannot persuade anybody anywhere that that's not true. At the same time, however, we do have mounting evidence in the 990s of an astonishing peace movement of lay people, peasants, knights, their ladies, and churchmen gathering in assemblies in France and also in Germany to try to ensure first a truce of God and then later a peace of God, at least in the realms in which they had some control. And these peace movements, as signs that you need some kind of significant change at the end of a century and at the end of a millennium, seem to recur at the ends of centuries, and we see it now around us at the end of this century.
Hillel Schwartz is my guest. He's a cultural historian, and he's the author of the new book, Century's End, which is about all the predictions at the end of centuries and at the end of millennia. Well, it seems to me now that we're approaching the year 2000, there are new ways to imagine the end of the world. We can imagine nuclear disaster. We can imagine the world ending in some kind of greenhouse effect or terrible pollution, interplanetary wars on a lot of people's minds.
Yes.
Do you think we're getting more creative now in predictions for the end of the world?
And more global. It used to be that the end of the world would come only to the people you knew about, and now it comes not only to the Earth, but perhaps to the galaxy as well. The sense that the world would come to an end with devastation, either natural or man-made, has been part of the phenomena at the ends of centuries for a long time. What gets more and more creative, rather, is our sense of what kind of new ages we can have. If you look at the scenarios for devastation, they're pretty much the same. The only difference is that with the nuclear, we have a sense that this can happen more quickly. But with our visions of what can happen after the turn of the century, these seem to be slightly more creative now because we have a higher sense of what our technology can do and also a greater foreboding about what our technology may not finally give us.
So do you think that the New Age movement has something to do with the approach of the year 2000 and that kind of a end of the millennium type thinking?
Oh, certainly. Although this Aquarius phenomenon, the Aquarian conspiracy and the rest, is not necessarily centered on the year 2000 per se. It's been growing in momentum ever since the 1970s as an end-of-century phenomenon. The New Age idea, in fact, comes from the late 12th century from an abbot in Italy who conceived of the world in three historical stages, a stage of the Father, a stage of the Son, and a stage of the Holy Ghost. He believed at the end of the 12th century that they were about to enter the stage of the Holy Ghost. This was going to be the New Age. And with the New Age would come a new avant-garde of spiritual men, more pure and more dedicated to the salvation of the soul and also to the salvation of the territories of Christendom. This New Age phenomenon, then, as a Third Age phenomenon, has become popular, and you can see the melding between the New Age rhetoric that's popular with channeling books and popular with astral magnetism and UFO reports, melded to the New Age literature and rhetoric concerning business, the third millennium of the business world, the third industrial revolution, sense that you must enter a third American century. These are two different worlds coming together with the same kind of concern about a new age.
We use the expression New Age rhetoric. You've been reading a lot of New Age materials. Do you find the writing to be hard to get through often?
Well, what happens is that in New Age materials, in order for them to explain why it's so important for us to be concerned at just this point, the material becomes highly numerological and astrological. These are two phenomena, of course, that have been with us for a long time, in fact, since at least the 12th century. But at the ends of centuries, the numbers become suddenly more significant. And so the number play becomes wilder and more extraordinary in order to convince us about the extreme significance of these numbers.
Well, I want to quote something that you quote in your book, Century's End, and this was written about the harmonic convergence. And this is by, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, José Arguelles.
Yes.
And it's from a book called The Mayan Factor, which was, I think, a Mayan analysis of using Mayan history to understand the 1987 harmonic convergence.
Using, among other things, the Mayan calendar, yes.
Okay. So he writes about that point at which the counterspin of history finally comes to a momentary halt and the still imperceptible spin of post-history commences. And he writes about the exponential acceleration of the wave of harmonic history as it phases into a moment of unprecedented synchronization and of a major evolutionary upgrading of the light-life radiogenic process. Hard to understand.
There are, in those few sentences you've read, a wonderful melding of different sources of centuries and feelings. One is the feeling that you have to come with a new energy source into the new century. At the end of centuries, you feel full of decay and degeneration. You look around you and see the world's falling apart faster than you can ever put it back together again. And you think there has to be a new source of energy. So talking about wave harmonics, talking about, as we do now, superconductors and cold fusion, these are part of that feeling that you need a new energy source. Then there's that second feeling that everything seems to be coincidental now. So there's a key word, a code word of synchronicity at the ends of centuries, that everything seems to mean something about the same thing now. And the third part of all this incomprehensibility that you were reading has to do with our feeling that if we are coming to a significant point, people must have anticipated how significant it would be. And so there must be a whole prophetic literature to look back to, just as the people in the French Revolution, just before the French Revolution occurred and during it, looked back to see what prophecies had predicted the French Revolution, including prophecies by Nostradamus. So we now, in the year 2000, have about 500 years' worth of prophecies to look back to say, this is what other people have expected for the year 2000. And Arguelles just goes them one step further and says, this is what the Mayans have been expecting for at least 2,500 years.
I'm sure you've been keeping up with a lot of apocalyptic literature and end of the century, movies and books and so on. Have any of them struck you as being as particularly tapping into popular thinking or popular fears about the end of the millennium?
The one I would talk about is Whitley Strieber's book Communion, which talks about aliens from unidentified flying objects abducting children, sucking something out of them, secrets about their biology, about the universe, about mankind, then returning them to live as somewhat unconsciously terrified strangers. It's a book which, on the surface, does not appear to be about the end of a century, but it is quite apocalyptic and quite terrifying and returns us to this theme of concern about the continuity of generations. And it becomes a movie as well. So it takes on a kind of potent imagery for us, this feeling that at the ends of centuries, we have put a burden on our children because they are our emissaries into the next century, at the same time that we worry about whether we can even grant them a planet where the species are no longer endangered, where the tropical rainforests still stand, leads us to this concern about our children as perhaps not having any more a childhood, as if the childhood were sucked out of them. So at the ends of centuries, for a book like Communion to appear, for people to be suddenly looking around at each other as possible aliens, is a truly significant sign of how concerned we are about the continuity of generations.
Well, two things I want to mention. One is that the movie based on Communion was a real flop. And also that Strieber's previous book was a real apocalyptic book. It was War Day. It was about the near end of the world through nuclear war.
Yes, it was. And it had, as its major hero, a set of survivors who looked at the world and thought that it wasn't going to survive much longer even after the nuclear war because there was flu and other disease. So, yes, inherent in what he was doing was both the thriller and a sense of apocalypse.
Do you want to warn us to be careful of what we buy into as we near the year 2000?
I wish I could feel that my warnings would do any good, but they won't.
Well, warn us anyway.
Well, what I'd rather do is create in everyone a consciousness about these two contrary motifs we keep feeling about anxiety and enthusiasm, and then say, well, no matter what, we're going to have these feelings at this end of a century, so why don't we use the energy generated by them to do something with them as opposed to becoming more confused, more complex, and use the year 2000, regardless of the debate about when the century and the millennium ends, use the full year 2000 as a way to implement things that you thought you didn't have the energy for before.
Sure.
Okay, so we'll all abandon our fields and devote ourselves to humanity in the year 2000, Terry.
See you there. Well, in the meantime, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. Now, my guest is cultural historian Hillel Schwartz, and the book we've been discussing is called Century's End, and it's about all the apocalyptic and New Age thinking that usually accompanies the end of a century or the end of a millennium, and where We're approaching both. Now, he's also the author of a book about dieting and the history of dieting and weight obsession, and that book is called Never Satisfied, and we'll be talking about that when we come back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Hillel Schwartz, can we force a connection here between diet obsession and the end of the century?
We can try one. That connection would be between all of the energy stuff I was talking about and the concerns people have at the ends of centuries with being revitalized and the diets that we now have at the end of the century. No one has come up with, and I think they should probably in the next couple of years come up with a millennium diet. But to force the comparison as best I can right here, although I wrote the books in the reverse order, the people now who are most promoting the most successful diets are constantly promising us not just a loss of weight and not just a change of appearance, but also a truly rejuvenated body. And the same time that our natural food stores carry energy bars, the diets themselves are promising that no matter what kind of regimen you're on, you're going to feel far more energetic. So all of that fatigue you're feeling from carrying around, and that's the words they use, carrying around this extra heavy weight and being immersed in all of this deadly fat. Well, let's take this, they say, all the diet doctors and the diet promoting agencies and Weight Watchers. Let's take all of this fear you have about heaviness and drowsiness and death and turn it around, change your life, and suddenly you will become not only a new person, but a person fit for a new century.
Hmm. Have you been collecting diet literature? Brochures and advertisements?
Oh, yes. I have files and files not only of the literature, but of about 500 diet books published before 1950. You might, if you look at any bookstore now, realize that a lot of diet books are on the market, but there's actually about 300 to 350 each year on the market since the 1950s. Before that, the first truly popular best-selling diet book came out right after World War I. During the war, Herbert Hoover, as part of the U.S. Food Administration, had been concerned to get people to change their diets and had begun to emphasize the importance of certain kinds of protein. But after the war, Lulu Hunt Peters, a woman who had syndicated columns in many newspapers across the country, published the first big-selling diet book with stick figure illustrations. And from then on, that book was reprinted a number of times. And then came a number of other books in the 1920s, which began to develop a series of other methods for dieting. So what happens if you look back at all this literature, this ephemera, as well as the diet books, is that quite often the diets in the 20s are the same as the diets in the 80s. The grapefruit diet was called the Hollywood diet in the 1925. But what happens is that each generation develops a new rationale for why an old diet will work, and that new rationale fits the cultural principles alive at the time. So the diets now, which emphasize vitamins and proteins and energy, are not diets that are necessarily distinctly different from those in the 50s or the 30s or even in 1915, but they have an entirely different rationale to them which fits the cultural presuppositions of our time.
Well, how does the grapefruit diet of now and yesteryear compare in its rationale?
Well, originally, the grapefruit diet was there because people had made the assumption since the 17th century that if you took something acidic, it would dissolve the fat inside you, the way acids dissolve things outside in the real world. And when they got inside your body, the acids would dissolve the fat and it wouldn't be absorbed, or it would be unloosened, unhinged, as it were, from the canals of your body. Now the grapefruit diet is something connected to vitamin C, and connected to energy, and connected to a sense of California, Florida, vitality, sunshine.
Does it disturb you when you turn on television and you see food ad after food ad from companies that are allegedly making diet food products? So we're being sold foods that will help us slim down, and these commercials are just making us really hungry for food.
I think we cooperate with the advertisers. We would like to have foods which taste scrumptious, but which give us no calories. We would like to have foods which have all essence, but no other properties at all. It's almost a metaphysical desire on our part. So when I see all those ads on TV, I relate it to this desire on our part for all of these diet foods that will give us taste without substance and that will give us the essence of life without weighing us down, a kind of ultimate weightlessness. By the way, there is an irony, as you might realize, to much of this advertising, because these huge conglomerate corporations very often own the fattening food products as well as the diet food supplements. So, for example, Heinz, which produces the ketchup for all those hamburgers, also owns Weight Watchers.
Well, have there been any books written yet about how at the end of the millennium, when we reach the year 2000, there will be fabulous foods without calories?
Oh, yes. There have been several articles.
Seriously?
In most of the major dailies and weeklies. Yes, you guessed it. About food in the year 2000, and what will it be? First of all, it would have, as an extension of the whole dieting principle, it would have tremendous taste, tremendous flavor, but it will not have great substance. It would be a lot of fish done in new ways. We are disenchanted, by the way, with that old image of people popping pills like spacemen up in orbit, eating their dinners with little pills. I have to tell you the story which fits both the end of the millennium and the dieting craze. In the 1890s, the most widespread image from all of the scientific extrapolations of what would happen by the end of the next century was that people would sit around elegant dining tables while butlers served them on these grand silver trays little pills, which were labeled roast beef and leg of mutton. We, at the end of this century, have the same desire, but we no longer think that we can do simply with the pill, because what we want, as all of the taste scientists say to us now, we want mouth feel. So at the end of the century, we're going to get mouth feel, but we're not going to have the calories in the food itself.
Well, Hillel Schwartz, I wish you happy eating and a good end of the century.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for talking with us. My guest has been Hillel Schwartz. He's a cultural historian, and he has a new book called Century's End, which is a cultural history of the end of century and end of millennium thinking. And he also has a book that's just come out in paperback called Never Satisfied, a cultural history of diets, fantasies, and fat. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Erstes Geschoss. Hier leben die Blinden, die glauben, was sie sehen, und die Tauben, die glauben, was sie hören. Festgebunden auf ein Küchen.
Our rock historian Ed Ward just got back from Berlin, where he sat in on a recording session with a no longer underground East German rock band. Coming up, Ed plays some records he picked up abroad that illustrate how rock is changing in Europe. Also, world music critic Milo Miles plays some new pop from Japan. And Laurie Stone reviews A Kiss is Just a Kiss. It's a new book of photos of couples kissing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The former president of El Salvador, José Napoleón Duarte, has died after a 19-month-long struggle against cancer. He was 64 years old. NPR's Scott Simon reports.
Mr. Duarte died shortly before noon today in San Salvador for almost 10 years. Support for José Napoleón Duarte was the foundation of U.S. policy in El Salvador. He was a Christian Democrat, a devoted Catholic, a victim of torture by the Salvadoran military, who was seen as a man whose moderation could reach both the left and right. He returned from exile in 1979 to lead a reform military junta running El Salvador. That decision gave him the power and the American support he'd always sought, but it also reduced his credibility among former Christian Democrats and active Catholics who joined the rebels. Mr. Duarte was elected El Salvador's first civilian president in 50 years in 1984. During his term, the number of murders committed by death squads declined dramatically, but corruption in his party and his inability to end the civil war had made Mr. Duarte highly unpopular by the time he became sick with the cancer that today ended his life. This is Scott Simon reporting.
In Washington, the White House says that President and Mrs. Bush were deeply saddened to hear of Duarte's death. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Duarte was called the father of Salvadoran democracy in a statement from Press Secretary Marlon Fitzwater, and that was just how the former Salvadoran president hoped to be remembered. In 1984, Duarte became El Salvador's first elected president in more than 50 years. A staunch ally of the United States, his government received billions in U.S. aid. On a visit to the White House a few years ago, Duarte kissed the American flag to show his gratitude. He was succeeded as president by Alfredo Cristiani, who represented the party founded by Duarte's arch-rival, Roberto Dabuisson, who was rumored to have ties to right-wing death squads. The White House statement said that Duarte was a strong supporter and exponent on behalf of human rights and social justice, and that his wisdom and dedication to the growth of democracy in Central America will long be remembered. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
While the health of the commander of the space shuttle Atlantis has improved, the weather has not. So liftoff has now been reset until Sunday morning at Cape Canaveral. Doctors say Commander John Creighton, who has been suffering from a head cold, is now able to fly. Air Force weather forecasters are predicting an 80% chance of good weather for Sunday after heavy rains and high winds pass through. President Bush has nominated Arthur Fletcher as the new chairman of the Civil Rights Commission. Fletcher ran for mayor in Washington, D.C. against the current mayor, Marion Barry, and he served in the Labor Department during the Nixon administration. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 10.5 points to close at 2,564.19 on volume of 148 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Pop music may be one of the last fields in which the United States enjoys a favorable balance of trade with Japan. Today, world music commentator Milo Miles begins a two-part examination of Japanese pop. As with many other items from that country, Milo says the best Japanese pop is a refined combination of foreign elements and native delicacy.
An international power like Japan naturally develops a very diverse popular music culture. Many of the most well-liked modes over there are not, in my opinion, very appealing to most Western ears. The sludgy heavy metal, the drab jazz fusion, the shrill baby doll girl singers. A couple of styles in Japan are much more fruitful and less blandly derivative, art rock and punk rock. This time we'll take up a main thread of Japanese art rock. Back in the mid-70s, one of the first Japanese pop groups to garner international attention was the Sadistic Mika Band. They were a not-bad-but-not-great outfit that spent several albums feeling their way towards smoother and more inventive mixtures of jazzy rock and electronics. A featured songwriter was drummer Yukihiro Takahashi. This is the Sadistic Mika Band's funky Mahjong. The Sadistic Mika Band were rough pioneers, but more progress was made when Takahashi hit it off with studio keyboardist Ryuichi Sakamoto at a recording session. The two formed the Yellow Magic Orchestra, which became enormously popular in Japan at the end of the 70s. Now, I'm not recommending any of the several albums available by the Yellow Magic Orchestra. In fact, they were quite awful. Lowest common denominator disco bleeps. Funny thing was, though, both Takahashi and Sakamoto emerged from the breakup of the band several years ago as much more accomplished and expressive performers. Takahashi is decidedly the lesser of the two, but for David Bowie fans especially, he's a must, as this sample from one of his recent solo albums shows. Speaking of David Bowie, he played the lead in the film Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, and the soundtrack for that was for a long time the most readily available Ryuichi Sakamoto album in the U.S. It's still a pleasantly atmospheric little tidbit, but the host of very short tracks don't show off Sakamoto's skills to the fullest. What's most intriguing about these skills is that Sakamoto can order from such a big menu of styles. He uses his extensive formal training to pull in not just the usual electronics and rock and jazz, but opera and Eastern and Western classical traditions up to and including minimalism. Sakamoto prefers thick percussion for a sort of clockwork funk that's more declarative than mechanical. Often his keyboard will simply embellish a rather complex repeated figure and play tag with guitars or saxophones or even a string section. But there's no easy way to categorize what Sakamoto will do from one number to the next. You might get a squirt of pure dissonance or a sassy female chorus. When he's really flying through styles and textures, his work suggests what a truly one-world music would sound like. All parts from everywhere comfortable together, each lending the others a bit of color. In his shifts, Sakamoto favors a harmonious whole, and his flair for calm unity grows more evident over the course of an entire album. His overall effect is curiously soothing. Some caveats are in order. First, Sakamoto has never decided on a satisfactory vocalist, so you'll have to settle for cameos by the likes of Iggy Pop and Thomas Dolby. Second, entirely orchestral works by Sakamoto lack fully developed dynamics and tend to become rather tedious, so go for collections with numerous cuts and pop orientation. Fortunately, one of the most robust representations of Sakamoto's pop, called Neo Geo, is also one of his most easily found in this country. Those who want more should go on to the album Illustrated Musical Encyclopedia. On the cover, Sakamoto is playing a grand piano and casting the shadow of a giant ant. It's appropriate. He works hard enough.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes about pop music for the New York Times and the Village Voice. Ryuichi Sakamoto's album, Neo Geo, is on Virgin Records. Illustrated Musical Encyclopedia is on the Japanese import label Ten Records. This is Fresh Air. Fresh Air rock historian Ed Ward has some music news from Europe. Ed was in Germany last fall at a conference for independent record labels. He just got back from another trip to Europe. He attended MIDEM, an international conference in France. That's a big marketplace where music industry people make deals and sample new records. He then went to West Berlin, and one day he crossed the border into the East and sat in on the first recording session of a popular but previously restricted rock band. We asked him to report back to us on the changing music scene in Europe.
The big news, I think, in Europe at the moment is that they have more or less left the old colonial cultures behind. The U.S. and Britain more or less dominated popular music in Europe throughout the 70s and well into the 80s. And although most of the new music takes its inspiration from Black American music, it's been transformed into something quite different. And there are new types of dance music coming up. The most spectacular, I think, is coming out of Belgium, of all places, out of Antwerp and Ghent, and it's called New Beat. It happened in a disco when DJs started slowing down some records and found out that people were really going for it. And I really enjoy the stuff. I think it's very unusual and weird, and it is absolutely not to the American taste. It has been impossible for record companies to market the stuff in the U.S. There's a bit of a scene in Chicago. There's another one, strangely enough, here in Austin. But for the most part, they really haven't been able to get it over.
Can you play us an example of New Beat?
Sure, sure. There is no such thing as a New Beat band. It's just people who go into the studio. And this is a band called Soccer Muzak, and the record's called Van den Beat. And if I'm not mistaken, this is a cabinet member from Belgium who was caught up in a scandal last spring and had to go on television and say that he was not a crook. And they got a hold of the press conference and played around with it a little bit.
Qu'est-ce qui se passe?
Je ne sais pas.
Okay, so that's an example of New Beat coming out of, well, this is from Belgium.
Yeah, Belgium and Holland are where that happens.
Any other big news at the conference in terms of Western Europe?
Well, yes. Back in the old days, you more or less had to sing in English if you wanted to get a hit, because the only way you could get a hit really would be to sell in America. At this point, a number of Western European nations have liberalized their radio laws. No longer are all the radio stations run by the state. It's possible for the private sector to get a radio station going. It still has to be licensed by the state. But this increased competition means that there's more airtime to fill, and thus a lot of independent record labels and independent musicians making more odd, less mainstream music have sprung up out of nowhere. And a response to this has been a lot of the state stations are now mandating airtime for independently produced records.
Can you play us an example of one of these independent records that's beginning to get more airplay, either on these alternate stations or on the state stations?
Well, here's a band from France that I'm particularly fond of. These people all live in Paris. Many of them are Spanish, some of them are German, some of them are Algerian. The band is called Mano Negra, and they've just put everything in the pot and come up with something fantastic.
Let's hear it.
Okay, here is a cut called The Rebel Spell.
I won't be ready, I won't be regular, working in the pub with my gun. I won't be ready, I won't be ready, I won't be regular, working in the pub with my gun.
Now it's my turn, I'm gonna take my gun.
Listen, brother Rastafari,
I work in the pub alone just like I'm with a mirror.
Listen, brother Rastafari,
they're gonna kill your son.
Listen, brother Rastafari,
I love my country, we ain't gonna shout and say.
While you were at the Meetum conference, did you hear any records by Eastern European bands that were previously underground and that wouldn't have been represented at this conference a year ago?
Yes, absolutely. There's really the Eastern European countries have not been aggressive in pushing their pop product internationally because they have always known it's inferior. But one day, two guys from Polskie Nagranie, which is the Polish national label, showed up at the booth very anxious to talk to me and pressed into my hand three records, one of which was a soundtrack from a movie. The other was a horrible jazz fusion record. And the third was a punk band called T-Love. And I looked at them and I thought, uh-oh, this has either got to be official socialist punk or else maybe it's the new spirit of Poland. And I played it, and gee, they're not bad at all.
Can you play it for us?
Yeah, sure. Here's a cut which is called Naja Tradycja, I think. Not speaking Polish, and I don't have no idea what it's about. Maybe some Polish people will help us out.
Do you think of this record as an example of Polish punk that's been very influenced by American punk, or do you think it's headed off in its own direction?
Oh, I think it's still very much a... somebody once told me that the underground bands in Russia sound like the sum product of their record collections. And I think that's very much the case here. But I think the bottom line is that they're certainly not an acceptable face of socialist Poland. These are some ugly dudes, and I know the Eastern Zone really likes to manicure their rock stars so they look like good examples to youth. These guys are not good examples to youth, and I say God bless them.
Well, you were in Berlin for 10 days on this recent trip, and you got to hear not only some German music, but you got to actually sit in on a recording session of a band. Now, this band is called Divisione.
They're called Division, D-I-E-V-I-S-I-O-N. It's sort of a multilingual pun having to do with division and the vision and, you know.
Were they previously an underground band, and was their status recently changed?
Well, they are the best known and best loved band in East Germany, but they were an official band. Now, let me explain what this means. In East Germany, there is a licensing procedure that you have to go through if you're a band. Division applied for their license and were only given second-level status, which meant that they could not get a recording deal with the state label and that they were limited to halls, I believe, of 600 or less. Uwe Geyer, who is the lead singer and chief songwriter, he told me that most of their gigs were at churches, in church basements. And actually, they liked that because churches were always the stronghold of resistance and sort of the gathering points for free speech. If you remember, the early demonstrations at the Berlin Wall started in a church that was very near the wall, Lutheran Church, where people would meet every Monday and then go out holding candles and head towards the wall.
So what kind of band is Division?
Division is a very interesting band. Once again, they're the sum of their influences, but I think Geyer's a really strong songwriter. I think it's a shame that he writes his lyrics mostly in English, although the album that they're in the process of making at the moment, in which I dropped in on the recording of, is geared towards the world market, and it is coming out on Amiga, which is the East German label, on some independent West German label, on an independent British label, and they'll be coming over here to try and look for a deal on an American independent label.
You like this band?
I do sort of like them. Yeah, the whole album I don't think is a masterpiece, but certainly there are a couple of songs that that knocked me out.
Can you play us one of those?
Sure. This one's called After the Sunset, and you know, it's not starkly political, but it's definitely got its political and anti-establishment side to it.
When the sun goes down and the holy water is all forgive and forget, sing a song with us for a better world, sing sha-la-la-la-la, sing an out loud song for a better world, sing sha-la-la-la-la.
Ask you what most interests you in the this unfolding story of Eastern European rock?
Well, I don't think it's the music. The music's not there yet in terms of what interests me. I think what's really interesting to me is to see something that I haven't seen since I was very young. The sort of idea that rock and roll is something new and fresh and that you can create what you want and people will respond to it. This is something we've sort of forgotten about over here in recent years, and it's very interesting to watch this all unfold.
Rock historian Ed Ward, this is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. José Napoleon Duarte, El Salvador's president for many years, has died. We'll review his career and his life. A Department of Transportation study shows that there is a danger of radiation exposure to airline crews and those who fly a lot, especially on the North Atlantic routes. The radiation could cause extra cancer deaths in the high-risk group. The point is, some researchers say that airline crews have not been warned of what amounts to an occupational hazard. Also, the zone planting map has been updated in time for spring gardens. And Bob Mondello reviews the new film directed by Bob Rafelson. It's called Mountains of the Moon.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A Kiss is Just a Kiss is a collection of photographs of people kissing that just got a big marketing push for Valentine's Day. The book is edited by Bruce Velick. Critic at large Laurie Stone says you might think it would be just sentimental, but it's more than that.
A Kiss is Just a Kiss sits in bookstores near the cash register, a confection meant to snare you like a box of chocolate truffles. But in this case, packaging isn't a cheat. The book is as luscious and rich to the feeling life as cocoa cream is to the tongue. 60 images of kissing have been shot by photographers, including Cartier-Bresson, Eisenstadt, Cortez, Ouija, and Winogrand. Together, they form a meditation on sensual play. While kissing, we are at our impulsive, giddy bests. Kisses may beckon sex and allude to private acts, but they are also often a social celebration, a spectacle on which everyone is invited to spy. So many pictures of kissing simplify and prettify human emotion. What marks this volume is an absence of sentimentality. It speaks of ambivalence, impulses, and drives. Even Joan Moss's photograph of two young children about to kiss is charged with awakening hunger and curiosity rather than conventional innocence. Some of the most arresting shots are about watching, where people are captured gaping and fantasizing, for that is what both kissing and photography inspire. Watching, we feel the frisson of memory or of fresh desire or of loss. In a famous picture by Robert Doisneau, taken on a Paris street in 1950, a young man plants a passionate smack on his lover's mouth and sets off a chain reaction of emotions. He has a bohemian air. A scarf is folded artfully into his jacket, and his hair is longish. For the couple, time and motion have stopped, but all around them, passers-by cast furtive looks. A man in a beret stares tight-lipped. A middle-aged woman seems alarmed. In the middle of ordinary life, erotic abandon whelms up, triggering anxiety and longing. But just as many pictures show couples engaged in episodes that no one but the photographer sees. In a photograph by Abbas, a young couple kiss, while around them three older people stare out in separate directions. It's a study in connection and disconnection, but the question is left open about whether the surrounding estrangement prompts the couple to unite, or whether their embrace triggers the ambient solitariness. Gripping, too, are photographs of people who so clearly belong together, it's eerie. In two photographs that face each other, one by Jean Gomi and the other by Chris Steele Perkins, the members of each couple look amazingly alike and remind us of the narcissism that fuels affection. Equally stirring are minglings that transgress conventional boundaries. Some of the most compelling shots are of same-sex couples and of human and animal pairs. In an odd shot, one old disheveled man plants a kiss on the forehead of another elderly man. They're in a train station. Each holds a cigarette. Has the impulsive kisser come into a windfall, or is he just feeling affectionate? Several delightful shots capture dog snouts caressing human faces, but the most surprising animal image, shot by Gary Winogrand at a state fair, shows the tongue of a huge cow unfurling to plant a smack on the cheek of the cowboy who is showing him. All the pictures in this book celebrate the victory of desire over repression. They smash artificially constructed boundaries between genders and species. Usually, we're directed to avert our eyes from sundered taboos. Here, we're invited to witness, contemplate, and drink in all we can.
Lori Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and author of the new novel, Starting with Surge. Well, we say goodbye to Karen Impala. She's going to KUNI in Cedar Falls, Iowa, to host a folk music show. Good luck, Karen. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You've probably heard recordings of Charles Stewart's now infamous call to Boston police saying he and his pregnant wife had been shot by a black man. On the next Fresh Air, TV critic David Bianculli tells us how one TV show got the whole tape as it happened. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.